Welcome to Refugee Radio.
Thanks for coming and braving the rain. I'm Steve from Refugee Radio, and this is your panel for the iRefugee Should I Stay or Should I Go discussion. Let's keep this civil, let's keep this polite, let's keep the heckling down, let's keep the language clean, especially Jacob, that goes for you.
Yeah.
Let's have a good time. Thank you.
So yeah, hello everybody, and welcome. My name's Jacob Birksom, and I'm meant to be hosting and chairing this debate today. I'm not going to say very much, I hope, because the point of today is really to do the thing that almost never happens, and I think there are interesting reasons why it almost never happens, which is hear from the voices of refugees. So often I think that when we're discussing immigration, migration, and refugees, the discussion is about refugees, but we never hear from them. So that's the aim today. What led you to make the decision to leave, the should I go question, and then also sort of what you were expecting on arrival in the UK, or what you were hoping to find here. And a little bit about what you've actually found here, the should I stay question. I think that might be just a nice place to start.
Hello everyone, really nice to meet you all today. I'm Rissel, I'm 15 years old, and I'm Kurdish from Syria. I've been here for about a year and 2 months now. So I am Kurdish from Syria, and I've been living in Syria for about like basically the whole of my life, so 13 years. When the war started in Syria, the war was just, it was kind of away from us, but we were included at the same time. I was 11 years old, no actually, I was 9 years old when everything started. And I was that kind of girl that was just trying to be away from everything that's happening. My mom and actually all of my mom's family were trying to just make me stay away from the politics and everything, because that's how much dangerous it was for me. And from a girl like at a really young age, it was really dangerous and threatening for me to talk anything about politics, like in public or like outside my house. So, and as a Kurdish as well, some of you might not know, but Kurdistan has just been struggling with actually trying to actually gain the identity and building the own country of them. So as being Kurdish, that was even like a more dangerous thing for me to talk about the president, to talk about the basically the war itself. So we really didn't want to leave Syria because it was everything that we had. We were really proud of being Syrians, and it was really good. We had a really great life there. But we just came to a point that it's dangerous for us to even stay at home, because we were so scared of, we were thinking of what if some day would come and we actually wouldn't have a roof, or we didn't have anything to actually live in, so we might just die in the street. So it was that point that we just had to, we didn't want to, we had to leave Syria, and we actually did. It was the 31st of May, 2 years ago, when ISIS started to kind of attack us and started to try to come to our city. We woke up, all of my family actually woke up at 4 a.m. the morning by the voice of a bomb next to us. It was 5 meters away from our house. So we woke up and we just didn't know what to do. We didn't know what was happening. We thought it was so horrible that we thought ISIS are in our house now. That's how scary it was for us. And for me and my little brother, actually, we didn't know what's going on. So we just wanted to just My mom's telling us, just go and just sleep, it's nothing. I think it's the voice of the television, the volume was up, so there's nothing much there. So we just tried to convince ourselves, yeah, it's nothing, it's just the television. So I took my little brother, he's 2 years younger than me. I took him and just told him, okay, just sleep and we'll see, everything's going to be all right in the morning. We couldn't sleep at all because that's how much horrible it was. We had our suitcases and all like the things that we had to take, like just like two trousers, two t-shirts and the stuff that we needed, just in case we actually have to run away. And this moment did come that we just had to run away because ISIS were like really close to actually come and get us, because in my house we were only girls, like mainly girls, like it was me, my mom, my auntie, my grandmother, and it was my little brother and my granddad as well. So for us girls, and I'm sure that you do know how the ISIS treat girls, it was so threatening for us, so we just wanted to leave the house. The YPJ, which are kind of like a smaller group of Kurdish people that were trying to kind of help people to run away from the city, helped us, and they managed to get us away, to kind of run away from the city. And I remember that I was actually crying because I didn't really want to leave my my friends, and because my family was still there, two of my uncles just didn't really want to leave, and my granddad as well. So I was really crying, I was really upset because I didn't want to leave my city at all, because even though the UK and actually the Europe and Australia were kind of a dream for me, because when I watched TV I was like, oh my God, mom, imagine me going there when I grow up, because how sick would that be? But I got to a point that I had the opportunity to leave my country, but I just didn't want to because I didn't think that I really liked my country that much. But we just had to leave it. We went to Iraq and we lived there for 1 year. And throughout this year, there was the UN program there. We went and applied there. We got like a couple of interviews there. And we actually could give us a way to actually run away and come to UK. We didn't have the choice, they made the choice to actually come to the UK. We really didn't mind, we just wanted a house that we can feel safe in. So yeah, they told us that the UK would be a really good country for you, especially that it was just me, my mom and my little brother, so especially for us, it would just be such a great future for us. And we were really happy about it. Like, I told my brother, like, you remember when we used to dream that we go to the UK and now we have the opportunity? So yeah, we actually got on a plane and we just came here. We found ourselves in the UK. The time went so quick that I remember it was like yesterday when I was running away from my house in Syria. I came here and all of my expectations were actually the reality here was much greater than what I thought the UK was. The people that treated me, it was great. The school, my friends, even the teachers helped me to build my confidence. Everyone that I met in the UK actually helped me to improve who I am and to actually be proud of who I am and about the journey that I've been through. So yeah, I'm really happy here. And about the question that I've been asked, should I stay or should I leave? If I have the chance and if I have the choice to make, I'd definitely stay here because I wouldn't think that there is a better place for me to stay in apart from the UK. So yeah, that's kind of my story that I really like to share with you guys. And thank you.
Hi everybody. Very nice to see you all coming to be part of this event. I'm Alex Ntung, originally from Eastern Congo, but also Rwanda, because of all the experiences I'm going to be mentioning about. The question, should I go, should I stay, is too luxury to ask yourself. I do remember still vividly, my parents, asking my parents, why should I go when you're staying? And who am I to disassociate myself with the community where we come from? Where I come from, we have not a concept of I. We use we. You know, and for me, I was saying to my parents, I can't. And they begged me, saying, look, just go. Somewhere, anywhere you find peace, call it, you know, live with the people in harmony and call that place home. And it was the first time they told me that my grandmother died was left behind because she could not run. By the way, I started with telling you about that question, but where I come from is in Eastern Congo, from a community of semi-nomadic tribe, Tutsi group, who happened to be in Eastern Congo because of the artificial borders in Africa, and because of who they are, being kind of more from Rwandan origin, they became they became target of persecution for many years. I've seen from childhood, I've seen so many things, burning villages, even what we read news, you know, headlines about Congo being the world capital of rape. I've witnessed such things when I was 9. To cut a long story short, it reached a point where I had to leave, and that it goes to the question I was answering. So I left because they were kind of begging me to go. And when I arrived in this country, the expectation I have, I'm going by the question you've asked, Jacob. I had been told that UNHCR will be at the airport. Basically, all you guys will be at the airport kind of waiting for me. Opening your arms. And I was expecting flags of UN. It wasn't that. I straight away I was sent to detention. Now, to be honest, comparing severity of issues I had experienced, I didn't see that detention was a problem. I had seen people being killed in front of me. I knew I had survived. I've lost 11 members of my own family. So for anything I was seeing at the airport, it was not a big thing, but it was quite a shock that I didn't see you there to welcome me. But in the detention, what I can say is there was incredibly some generosity. I was used to see, you know, police opening small hole window, giving us something to eat. But by the way, was the first time I've seen it's bread and some leaves in between. And I just think, this why people eat like goats? You know, they eat leaves? Is this a place in which I come from? You know, I come to ask for it. I know, yeah, I didn't go that far, but it was quite funny. I had to take leaves outside the bread and eat the rest. But something which was shocking too was they were asking me when I was born, and I stayed in detention for quite a long time. Well, a long time, I'm exaggerating. 1 week, the first detention. And simply because they were finding that I'm not credible because I said, I don't know when I was born. And seriously, I don't know when I was born. I know my mom went to find firewood in the forest and had me. I'm not saying she found me there, but that was the way I was born. So in a situation like in Congo, near the Ren forest, in the middle of nowhere, it's too luxury to know when you were born. I know I was born in raining season, and I keep saying to them, I was born in raining season. They didn't want to believe me. And of course, they go by ticking boxes. You're good, you're credible. And anyway, I think that was the first impression. But getting here, it took 4 years before they accepted me to stay in the country. And that was, again, another really little bit disappointment. But I enjoyed the generosity of people who are involved in volunteering, supporting, and you compare all that goodness versus the system. I started kind of rationalizing that to know that I'm not being mistreated by people, I'm being mistreated by the system. Thank you.
Hello everyone, I'm Kuka Aibo from Southern Cameroon. Nice to see all of you here. I'll just give a brief biography of myself and how it all ended that I found myself in the UK. I was born in a town called Bamenda in southern Cameroon, and I grew up in that town. Have to leave that town to a French part of Cameroon, where I had my education, and it was difficult to have a job in that French part. You know, Cameroon is divided into two, the French part and the English part. So I come from the English part, which was colonized by Britain. So the very first reason that I decided to come to Britain was the root, the link that we had with Britain from the start. So I got involved in this activism because we found out that what was going on between the French and the English speaking, the discrimination was just too much. And our fathers have started the fight before for equal opportunities. They never got through the fight, so we continued it. During that period, I was arrested several times, incarcerated, and all the torture, you know what happened in Africa. I went through all everything, and in December 2010, there was a presidential election in Cameroon. And we decided that we have to stop this presidential election and sit on a table, in a negotiating table, and discuss this problem between the French and the English people. It didn't turn out well. The oppressive regime have to hunt us down, and everybody that spoke up have to hunt them down. Fortunately, I escaped to Nigeria and managed, through the help of some friends and relatives, managed to escape from Nigeria and found myself in the United Kingdom. I was very happy to be where I could speak the language. I know the culture already. I knew I was somewhere safe, so I had to approach the authorities and told them, this is what happened to me in Cameroon, so I need your protection now. For the authorities to protect me, I instead found myself in detention. I was detained in Hammersworth for 6 months. I took it normal. That was immigration detention. I said, okay, maybe you want to check my background from Cameroon, if truly I'm saying the truth about what happened. It took 6 months. I was in Hammersworth. On one fateful morning, after about three attempts to deport me unsuccessfully, one fateful morning I just saw, they came and they said, I'm leaving Hammersworth to Portsmouth, to another detention center. That was not an immigration detention center. That was that's a prison. I don't know. We all know what where the Portsmouth prison is. It's not an immigration detention center. It's for criminals. So I was sent to Portsmouth. When I arrived Portsmouth, I said, "But it has happened. I just have to bear it. I've been in prison before, so I just have to face it." I tried, because I was very quick to react. I will tell you that I was very, very quick to react since I went to Hammersworth. I came through a refugee radio just through, because I was fast to search for information, look who to contact, and that's how I came to refugee. I came to contact Stephen for a refugee radio. I was still in detention when I contacted a refugee radio. So when I got to prison in Portsmouth, the very first day, I asked for a computer. I needed to use the computer and the internet. So what I discovered there was that for you to use the computer, they have to give you a password before you log onto the system, a password that you use. So whatever thing you do on that computer, they control it. You don't have any right to anything. So when they told me that, I just sent a short email to my solicitor just to tell him where I was. And that was it. They saw the email and they came directly and shut off the computer. The SIM they gave me was their own SIM they have there at Portsmouth. You don't have right to your own SIM. You don't have right to your phone. So you want to use a SIM, they give you a SIM. So basically, I had no communication. I had no privacy. I couldn't speak anything over the phone or over the internet. Luckily enough, the following morning, the solicitor came and we did some few paperwork. And I was released on temporary admission after a week in Portsmouth. To cut the short story, the long story short, because I think people would like to speak as well, I'll still come back to it. I was given a temporary admission and I found myself into the community. I started to volunteer. I said I want to help the community. I need to give back to the community. So I contacted the Red Cross. I had to volunteer with the Red Cross. There's another charity still in London that I tried to visit, those in prison, which I still do to today. So I've been doing the activism since I left detention, and I'll have a lot more to tell you. I just want the other speaker to say something first, then we'll continue from there. Thank you.
Hello everyone, it's good to meet you. My name is Joseph Kasirye, I'm from Uganda. Good to see you. I came in this country not as a refugee. I came here to do my studies, but I was born in Kenya and I was living in Uganda. I have no problem with it, because we know we have to keep it separate to live in Uganda if you're a gay man. And I managed that, to live in Uganda. So when I joined the college here, that was 2004. Towards the end of 2004, a friend I had in Uganda, I used to live with as a gay man, he got attacked. He was not killed, he survived, but he changed the cities where he used to live. And I called him, he said to me, oh, it looks like I got found out, now they know I'm gay. I said to myself, okay, if now they know, they will know about me. Then I made a choice not to go back after consulting all my friends here, and I was like, you don't need to go back. I didn't finish up my colleges because I ran short of money as well. So I was advised by the friends to apply for asylum on the basis of my sexuality, because before I got here, I didn't know about it, and you can claim asylum on your sexuality. I applied for it in 2005, and it got rejected. They took it to the court, and then it got thrown out as well. They told me, you have to keep signing on as you are preparing to go back. I said to myself, okay. I didn't go to Ceylon, I absconded and then I ran away. That was 2005. All the next 9 years, I just lived in hiding because I didn't want them to take me back in Uganda. So 2016, I managed to meet up activists, and then I got involved with the pro-activities and then fighting for human rights and then the gay rights and LGBT asylum rights. I got involved with Movement for Justice. A friend of mine introduced to Movement for Justice. I stayed with them for 1.5 years, and then after that in 2017, that is last year, I claimed again, I put a new fresh claim with the Home Office. This time, it took them 6 months to give me the appointment to attend my interview. They well knew I was living in South London, where the Home Office is, that is Croydon, and I was living in Mitcham. They took me to Newcastle, 300 miles away from London, to do my interview. And the letter I got, they told me, if you don't attend, it will mean that you failed your interview. I did manage to get the friends to go to Newcastle, and then it took them 2 months to respond to the interview. This time, they granted me to stay here. The question of should I stay or should I go? Or am I welcome here? I would say, all the people here in this room, you welcome me and thank you for that. But the system doesn't. So I'm kind of, should I stay or should I go? I don't think I'll ever decide on that. I'll just leave every day that comes. Thank you for coming.
So Joseph, I want to start discussion, just talk a little bit. Talk a little bit about, you know, your experiences with Move for Justice. You obviously met a lot of other asylum seekers, people claiming asylum on political grounds. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you found the experience of claiming asylum as a gay man, as an LGBT person, and how that might differ in some ways from or be similar to, I don't know, other kind of asylum applications.
Thank you, Jacob. Claiming asylum as an LGBT person is got more involved. You have to prove yourself that you are gay, which is very, very difficult to prove to anyone. When I applied for the first time, they did ask me, do you have a partner? I said to them, I don't have a partner. And they said, okay, so that means you are not gay. But that is the system. With the political asylum seeking, don't know, but it is still the same. To prove, I had to tell my solicitor this time, because last time I didn't know, to get my country information to the Home Office so they will know how a gay man or a gay person or an LGBT person can survive in Uganda. Because I've gone telling them through from your day of birth, you know yourself, you are gay. And then you know in the society it's not allowed. So from the start, you start planning how you're going to live your life in the society, which I didn't manage until 25, because I came here when I was 25. And getting here, I had to prove it for the second time for them to believe me. It is very difficult to put your case through as a gay man in the system in the UK. As much as they say, everyone say, oh, it is legal now, you can live as a gay man. Okay, but in the community, still you get picked on. Sitting on a bus in my as a black man, I still have my black friends that I live around, I associate with a lot. When I'm around, you can still see their faces. It's like, he's there. It's like, what is it all about? Yeah, I'm here. But because the system, they can't do anything to you, that makes you a bit more comfortable. But back home, it's not like that. Once someone says, he's there, maybe it could be your last day.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I just take it on that. I mean, so not the system, but I mean, the UK has sort of projects itself sometimes as being somehow progressive because there's gay marriage, there's some sort of pro-gay stuff, David Cameron giving interviews to Attitude magazine sort of thing. I mean, how have you found the response of the LGBT community here to you and to kind of struggles for gay liberation back home? You know, what's that been like?
To me, the LGBT community, I'm involved because I got a charge when I go in Camden, it's an LGBT charge, and then I got another organization, it's called Rainbow Pilgrims. We're trying to promote our sexuality and then the, all the history of the LGBT people, and then get to meet all the LGBT asylum seekers, because that's where they can get the really support. The support they get from the government or from the system is just saying it, but it is not happening. It's not on the actual ground. You don't get it. They will say, oh, gay marriage has been recognized and then you can live as a gay couple. But still, you get picked on by the community. On your life, you get. Trust me, you get picked on, because I am still get picked on when I'm on the bus or we're walking on the street with a friend. They will still say, "Oh, he's gay," but the government will say, "No, now he's legal." So it's still, I'm not totally confident, and then I'm not, as a gay man, I am not totally. It's not like I'm not. I still feel I'm not accepted. I still have that feeling.
You're listening to the Refugee Radio programme. This recording was made during a public discussion in January entitled I Refugee, Should I Stay or Should I Go? The event was held at the Old Courtroom in Brighton and it was organised by Refugee Radio with Heer Al-Kabulin and was chaired by Joseph Birksen of the Thousand for a Thousand campaign. You can find out more information about these organisations and their work in the community via our website www.refugeeradio.org.
My name is Robert Mangi. I just want to echo on what the panelists have all been highlighting regarding immigration. The first thing which I will say is I am a refugee and I've got refugee status. I come from Southern Cameroon. Just like Abubakar has been saying, I've lived here for more than 16 years now, close to 17 years. I was in limbo for more than 15 years. I have taken a toll on my life. I've lost 15 years, I want to get it back. I can't even recover. I've got two kids born in this country. It is a challenge. The first thing I must say that the British people are fabulously credible when it comes to the traditional policy of helping those in need. But what is failing was asylum seekers or as a system. The system is very appalling. The system is very dehumanizing, I would say it. You understand? And one thing I don't understand, and I'm so grateful that a lot of people here are British, we need to start asking ourselves, why does the British government does not allow asylum seekers to seek asylum in this country and be given the entitlement to work, one, to fend for themselves, two, to contribute to the economy and to make this country a better place. In the United States, when you seek asylum, you don't depend on the government. Immediately they give you the right to work, to take care of yourself, and to support the system. In the meantime, the process of application, asylum application, as much as it is in Germany and other European countries. But yes, it is different. Like he is saying, how many asylum seekers, thousands and thousands of millions of them, we want to come here and seek asylum and be given the right to work. Allow us to work. Why you process the asylum application? We contribute to our to the economy and we help to support ourselves. When you begin to allow people to live on this culture of depending on the state, if when you even give them that status, they don't want to work anymore. Britain is undergoing austerity, just like the Chancellor is saying. They are cut day in, day out. There are a lot of people who need help in this country. People are disabled. They can't, the government cannot even care for them. Yet the government is wallowing a lot of money on asylum seekers. Whether they should have given them that right, that okay, I'm going to process your application, but I'll give you the right to work, to support us and to support the system. They don't do it. It's something we need to talk about it. It is draining the system and it's not good at all. And it's encouraging this culture whereby when you give you the right to work, when they give you even the status, you don't want to work. It is very bad at all. The second thing which I want to talk about is the indefinite detention. Like we've all highlighted, somebody that has gone through persecution in his own country comes here for humanitarian protection. You take him and you detain him. That is unbelievable. That is appalling. You understand? We need to shut down all these immigration centers. We are not criminals. And I see no reason why they should keep us with other criminals, people who have raped, people who have murdered, people who have broken, who have done terrible crimes. It is not good at all. Thankfully, I belong to a lot of charities that have developed my skills and a lot of work. I belong to like the Right to Remain. I think they're fighting this issue of what they call a fast track. This is when you make an application and the Home Office seem not to believe your case, they put a fast track thing, which is all about 1 week. That's what he went through. And 1 week be done with your case. Thankfully, I think that is being eroded. But much needs to be done.
Yep.
The British people are so fabulous. It is the system. And then the appalling thing is that this is what they call illegal immigrant. There's a word in English they call euphemism. You cannot be calling a human being illegal immigrant. I mean, this is an English country. I am an English student. This is the way you call somebody. You can call somebody undocumented migrants or unsettled migrant. When you give this appellation, and there are a lot of people who pick on that, you know, and look at asylum seekers, what derogatory human beings. They don't deserve a life. Oh, they come here. They're economic migrants. This is the way you call people. That makes it suitable, and then make them accepted in society. So we need to change this appellation of illegal immigrant and the way they people.
Just ask to finish up. the purposes of the way we're treating refugees, and then perhaps also say something about how it should look.
I'll touch on this answer on the issue of fast track. It took the pro activists to fight that fast track to win it in court. Not the government gave it, but winning it in court, ruling that it's unlawful, get an asylum case, failing, send them back, or appeal from there. It took in court to say to the government, no, that's wrong. So on the issue of the technologies and then the political system of this country is I'll touch on the Brexit. In the organization I'm involved in, it was run on the racist vote. I'll call it a racist vote because the government did confuse or did lie to people, like these asylum seekers, they get here, all the European people, they come here, they take all your money, they take all your NHS, so that's why you're not getting drugs, there's no doctors in their hospitals. But these EU people, they come here and work, and their money, so they don't take anyone's job. But it's the politician made the people think, oh, we going for a referendum, we'll have more jobs, or we'll have more care images, but it is gone worse. So that's why they're in the situation of confusion now. Can we stay in the single market? They already knew it's not going to work for them, for Britain, if they are not in a single market. But why did they introduce the referendum? That was a racist vote. On the issue of the detention centre, everyone here, I want you to join, like I'll say, join my group, because we are fighting to shut the detention system, not even have a limit on it or shut them because they are not of use. I've got some of these leaflets on the door there. Anyone can pick one and then go and read through. We will demonstrate against detention on the 24th of March, and then we'll put it on the Facebook for you guys if you want to come down to fight this. The power never concedes anything if there is no demand. There are some detention centers that have closed, but he's been demanding that you got demanding so they can shut them. There is no use for them. Thank you, guys.
So yeah, Russell, I mean, how do you understand the basis of the system here and how should it work?
as As a refugee, we didn't really choose to come here. We had to. The situations and the conditions in our country made us have to come to here. Like, obviously, we didn't have the choice to come here. So if they want us to come back, they need to make sure that we're safe, because at the end, we are kind of a little, even though we're not a complete part, but we kind of are a part of the community in here. So I think that if we want to come back there, in my case, in Syria, it might look that the word has been on for like 8 years now, and yeah, I think it's the time for it, them to actually, like, the war is finished and Syria is safe again. But actually it is not, because they're only believing what there is on the news, and that's not the truth, because I still have my family in Syria and I do exactly know what's going on there. So I think going back to Syria wouldn't be the best choice that we can make or the government will make. Yeah. So basically, I just want to say that we are still humans. We still have the rights to live. Being refugees doesn't mean that we have less rights than the normal people. That's just wrong. And going back to Syria wouldn't be the best thing to do now. Not only for Syria, but even other countries that are in danger.
Yeah. And,
yeah. Firstly, let me take opportunity to apologize on behalf of our panel that we focus on experience more than opinion, but I guess it's good too, because you are involved in such work, you already know the answers when it comes to opinion. I guess the experiences are so good too, and that's what we focus on. Maybe I shouldn't apologize. Anyway, to answer the question, two things. I've been doing activism around these issues, and I realize, I'm sorry to say, how little we can achieve through activism. You are stereotyped as being emotional. You go to the parliament with the posters. Frankly, you become kind of like a social group. You leftist, all those names. And really, I went kind of trying to look at a business case around activism. And if you try to look at it, you could achieve a lot about a long time. Long time, really. You could achieve a lot by kind of like raising awareness. You kind of win some kind of a soft hearts who wanted to hear more. But it's really a very challenging approach. Now, going to what should be done, I think two things. Education. I don't know why this is so obvious. Ways to mainstream all these debates, these discussions, and to be able to change future society. If we need to recycle, a kind of a filter a society, why not? We need to create a future that's similar to kind of campaign on climate, on environmental issues. We need to be filtering societies with terrible attitudes and that dehumanize other people. And the only way to do that, I'm not saying we need to brainwash children, but we need to be teaching and preparing public sector workers and education, not just like a training, like one of a half day staff development day. It has to be a culture. It has to be a part of culture of the council. With schools, the research show that children between 7 and 14, that's when they form attitude and values that could last long or their lives. So this is a time when we can actually be able to, instead of doing myth-busting or, kind of challenging the statistics that are coming out from the Daily Mail, you could educate, we could change this curriculum to be able to respond to these issues. Secondly, law. Is an amazing opportunity there. But again, it requires sophisticated campaigning. It's not just about demonstrating. It requires really being able to lobby MPs so they can be on your side, so they can be able to actually come up with something that will change situation in much more longer term. What is worrying now is that I often said in the past, before Brexit, I used to say that the philosophy of Ubuntu, which is the word from Central Africa, meaning human kindness. But behind that philosophy is that I am who I am because of other people. No, there's no one self-made person. Somehow you've been influenced by teachers, by parents, by family, by friends. You cannot say you are just you. Now, I used to say that, but I thought maybe it's not applicable to this culture, to this country, but it is applicable. Look, Brexit, personally, I do argue that it is a result of rise in right-wing populist movements, climate of xenophobia. It is part of the dilemma between national interest versus solidarity within the EU. And therefore, what affects us over there is affecting us here. So it affected us yesterday, but it's affecting you or us now. I'm one of you, is affecting us. So in long term, somehow that migration angle, that attitude has changed the politics narrative within this country. So something we're seeing in one of the corner of the world, what is happening over there is affecting us one way or another indirectly. So really, that's what we need to be doing, whether we want it or not, and whether we are kind of more progressist in understanding, but there is also necessity aspect. We cannot survive just alone. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm Councillor Andrew Wheels, Councillor for Central Hove. And I'd just briefly say thanks to all the panel members on my behalf as well, because I've really found today very, very interesting. Just got a set of random thoughts to just contribute to the debate, particularly I'm a Remainer in terms of the Brexit discussions. I do accept that part of the reason why Brexit went the way that it did is xenophobia and racism. I also think we as a group need to recognise that particularly poorer cohorts in our society have seen their, certainly since the recession in 2008, have seen their incomes and economic security under great threat. And so it's sort of one of those great big, it's sort of the worst of all worlds in terms of, you know, having that blamed on immigration or whatever is bad. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that then ends up people throwing toys out of the pram and just, you know, sticking two fingers up to their rulers. And so I'm sure that's part of what happened. I like the remarks about education. I think we take one of the things that's in this is that that our schools are particularly good about tackling bullying of all forms. And if you look at the Safe at Will at School survey in the city, there is the bullying rates for migrants are low as they are for other groups. So I think that's particularly encouraging. What is not encouraging is the rise of hate crime, not just in Brighton and Hove, but across the country, and that's in there. And I think we need to recognise that. I think also all of us that are on the sort of liberal end of the immigration debate, if you like, need to recognise that there isn't a consensus in this country about immigration, and we need to recognise that that we do have neighbours that are very, very concerned about high immigration numbers here and pressure on resources that may, particularly housing and space resources in the southeast that brings. You know, I've been to canvass in by-elections that were caused by Conservative MPs migrating to Brexit and did a lot of to UKIP and did a lot of door knocking in those areas, and you do consistently get from people feeling very vulnerable about a lot of things, their economic security, but also about immigration. So it's something that the politicians respond to. And then the last thing I wanted to say, I'm a firm believer, is in that the immigration authorities are a law unto themselves. There's no vote in a fair, nice, beautiful, lovely immigration system, and that's part of the problem. And I think that's why those of us with voices have to make them heard very loud and clear. So thank you all for coming today.
Just quickly, I thought to mention something which are less of a common knowledge. And if there's any journalist here to probably investigate on that. There is something that is not talked about, don't read about it in newspaper, but could really be an amazing opportunity to educate the public. Now, there is what they call Tier 2 visa application. It is an amazing or an exploitative opportunity for the government. So now, a family of four, for example, pays £5,000 for 3 years visa. A family of four, for over 5 years, we pay about £8,000. On top of that, they still have to pay £200 for NHS surcharge. I know NHS is talked about a lot, but without actually any counter argument that actually people who are applying for visas under work permit visas, they pay for NHS surcharge, plus they pay NHS within their taxes. So the amount of money that are worked out based on the numbers of people who apply such tier two visas, 9 out of 10 are denied visas, despite they have paid their money. £677, they still be denied visas. So how much is a huge money that comes to our economy? Are we losing or we are gaining? Thank you. I promise I want to come back.
Thank you.
No.
Thank you. He just mentioned something I was about to say, but I will start by, I'll go back to a counselor. He mentioned about housing problems, and I believe I have a solution for that, a partial solution for that housing problem. If we close down all the detention centers and build and use these sites to build social housing, it will go a long way. We use the sites to build social housing, it will partially solve the problem. So that is part
Thank
of my
you.
Solution.
Thank you, that's very helpful.
So, something I want to say is about this NHS social fee. The panel member was saying about it right straight away. And me in particular, we that come from Cameroon, Southern Cameroon, we have something linking us, an umbilical cord linking us with Britain. Upon that, we are a Commonwealth country. We speak English, we study in English, and when we apply to come here, we have been asked to write English tests. I'm going a little bit out of context, sorry for about that, but it goes boils down to the same thing. We are asked to write to prove our English proficiency. And I begin to wonder how somebody from maybe Bulgaria or Poland who doesn't speak English, I'm sorry to say that, but it's something so pertinent. Somebody from Bulgaria, Poland, or any other EU country that doesn't speak English, he's allowed to come to the UK freely, just straightforward. You come, you enter the system, you apply for benefit or whatsoever, I think, it goes, and that's it. You don't speak English. They've not asked you to write any English to prove any English proficiency or something. You don't pay the NHS surcharge. And still yet, the government complained that the NHS is, they are in short of money or whatsoever. Because all of this is not properly handled. It is not said the way it is supposed to be said. It's pathetic. It's so appalling that these laws maker doesn't see the things how it should be. Yeah. If we actually on that NHS issue, if we have to make NHS look the way it has to be, if there is an NHS surcharge, anybody applying and coming into UK, let that fee apply to anybody coming from the Commonwealth country or from the EU. That will balance the equation, because when those coming from the Commonwealth countries and whatever they pay the energy surcharge, those coming from the other part, they don't pay. So when there's that treatment, they become that downfall comes, because one part has paid, the other part is using the services, and there's that gap. So I still ask the question, why does the people coming from EU, they don't pay the NHS surcharge? Why don't they do the English test before entering into the UK? It should be a flat platform.
So that, I think, is a very nice note to finish on. Got a couple of sort of quick announcements, and then we'll thank the panel. But there is something, I think. This is my reflection on the day, and I'm going to shout out loud now, annoyingly, that this system. There is something very odd about a system that is so unequal that puts people. You know, in Brussels' case, works very well, and is wonderful, and is a great poster child for immigration, and in others. Our friend in the audience, 15 years of destruction. I think that this kind of divisions and then a very unequal immigration system perhaps is something my reflection on this, something that's perhaps deeply, deeply problematic, and that maybe we can sort of focus on our attention on having a system where everybody within the country is on an equal footing, and that might be made for a much better and more diverse and more joyous community. So there's my reflection from the panel. There's a few things we should say, because there's lots of events and exciting other stuff. So the first is Alex can talk about his book that he's got a few copies with, which is a very exciting and interesting book. Do you want to say a little word about it?
Not much to say, but it's not. I have four copies. If anyone wants to get them, that's fine.
And it's called?
Not My Worst Day. It's about my experience in Rwanda and the Congo before I came to this country.
Yeah. And to find out more about Alex's story, there's a book there.
Can I just... Yes. One second. A thank you to this member of panel here, this child. It's really sad to see a child of 9 years who left Syria to actually sit here and talk about her experiences. It's really, really, really hard. Because I know what she must have gone through, and we really need to applaud her for that.
Yeah. You're listening to the Refugee Radio program. This recording was made during a public discussion in January entitled "I Refugee, Should I Stay or Should I Go?" The event was held at the Old Courtroom in Brighton, and it was organised by Refugee Radio with Hear Al Kabulin, and was chaired by Joseph Birksen of the Thousand for a Thousand campaign. You can find out more information about these organisations and their work in the community via our website, www.refugeeradio.org.uk.